from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. We're talking about COVID-19 and its many implications across our community today. And one of the places where it's most notable in terms of the effect is in the education system. All up and down the spectrum, schools are doing what they can to get students off campus and move instruction online, or in this case, into the home. And right now we're talking in particular about the La Crosse School District with the Associate Superintendent of Instruction for the district, Dr. Troy Harsey. Dr. Harsey, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So this is quite a predicament that not only your district, but really every district across the state is under, as students are now home. There isn't any instruction going on in schools across the state. How long is that expected to last? Do we know yet?
Well, and that's part of what's difficult right now is it's shifting. It's a moving target. We had thought at one point here very recently that this was going to be coming to an end with the governor's mandate in early April. And one of the things that's been a bit of a moving target is a word in his last mandate, the word indefinitely, as this public health crisis continues. And that word indefinitely has changed for a lot of districts around the state the game plan going forward. So there's a lot of us talking through our CESAs and through our professional organizations what that means for our students and our staff and our communities instructionally and through our business departments and through feeding of children, et cetera.
What's a CESA?
It's a cooperative educational agency. So we have a CESA 4 here. It's located in West Salem here locally. In fact, there was a 1 o'clock meeting that I jumped out of as districts from around the area were talking about what will this mean instructionally for us. And there's a broad umbrella of what that might mean, and you were touching on a little bit with online instruction, digital instruction. What does that mean for students with individual education plans, IEPs, and honoring those? We have a legal mandate to meet those. And the longer that this closure continues, how do we meet those plans? And then once school resumes, if it resumes, do we have to have compensatory services to meet those plans? So there are a lot of questions, particularly with so many unknowns and with news coming out daily, hourly. We're all scrambling a little bit to try to do right by our communities and by our community's children.
I know it's impossible to say with exact certainty in every single case, but is there a way to sum up in general what students might be experiencing, what their families might be experiencing in terms of their education? Are they getting sent either online or delivered somehow physically packets of information to go through, of school material to go through, or are they getting online face-to-face time with actual instructors, kind of like when a college class goes online, or what's happening there?
Yeah, and I think this might be happening differently per district and then per level. So what I mean by that is it might be looking a little bit differently for a high school student and their readiness level versus a middle school level, and then when you're looking at even a fourth or fifth grader versus somebody who might be pre-K through third grade. So when we received word that the governor was mandating that we're going to have a closure of schools at our earliest grade levels, the first thing that we did was we went to our library media centers and we got as many LMC books as we could, and we made sure students were leaving with resources to make sure that they were able to have some literacy in the homes and were able to read. We want to make sure they're working on numeracy and literacy over this break. And at that time, we thought it was going to be perhaps a few weeks. We're fortunate in this district that we have taxpayers have supported a one-to-one technology program. So fourth grade through 12th grade, our late elementary, our middle schools have iPads, and our high schoolers have laptops that they were able to take those with them. And so now that we've gone through our phase, what we're now calling a phase one, which we were really considering kind of a digital connections and continuity, where we were having students and staff making sure that they were connecting, because a lot of students, a lot of parents, a lot of grandparents are, you know, obviously quite anxious about this. But now that we're hearing this word indefinitely and we don't quite know when we're going to be back, we are planning in the school district La Crosse, like perhaps a lot of districts around the state, a phase two, where we're planning about what would it look like if we need to ramp this up and have a more robust curriculum, more robust assessments and grades and et cetera, those kinds of considerations going forward for really what could be a quite an extensive stay out of school.
It's not just education that people have come to depend on the school system for. Through many years of offering food programs, lunch, breakfast, even for many students, for low-income students, the main source of their nutrition during the course of the school week comes from the school. What's happening in terms of the school lunch program?
Yeah. Starting today, in fact, we have great partners throughout the La Crosse community, as many communities do. But we were able to work with our bus company, for example, Go Right Way, and we started 10 different bus routes throughout our community with at least three stops apiece. And we were delivering both a breakfast and a lunch to anyone 18 years and younger, and just to make sure that students were being fed, because as you were pointing out, schools do a great job of educating students. That's not all we do. We really wrap around students in a lot of different ways. Food, clothing, shelter. Schools do provide psychological, educational, physical safety in a lot of different ways. And so one of the ways that we're going to hopefully be able to continue throughout this closure is to be able to feed children and families as best we can. And again, we wouldn't be able to do that without great partners. We had a kind of a call out to staff members. This takes a lot of hands on deck to be able to make something like that happen. We needed volunteers, and staff members came in droves to ride on these bus routes, to deliver meals to families and children. And we're going to continue that Monday through Friday while we're closed.
And you talked about the staff members lending a hand. I know in this era of social isolation, we're out of one side of our mouth telling people to isolate and stay home and not be in contact with other people as much as possible. And yet there are needs, and people are looking for ways that they can help. From the school district perspective, what kind of assistance is needed? Is there a place where people can donate if they can, or is there a place where people can even volunteer if they're not in a high-risk category?
Yeah, if people go to many school districts, not just ours, but of many school district websites, there are opportunities to click on tabs that would indicate ways in which they might be able to offer a lending hand. And certainly there are a myriad of ways in which that can be done. But at least initially here, while, for example, the school district La Crosse is getting their legs underneath them and parents are getting used to having children at home and for long durations of time, you know, right now, one of the needs that we're communicating, for example, with La Crosse County Health Department and local YMCAs, et cetera, is a potential surge in need for daycare support. Doctors and nurses and law enforcement officers, et cetera, need to be working, we're considering all the different avenues where we might be able to lend a hand with safety first in mind, meaning we've got a ban on gatherings of 10 or more, those kinds of considerations, and how might we be able to provide a hand and make sure that we're practicing what we preach and keeping people and children and families safe.
Dr. Troy Harsey is the Associate Superintendent for Instruction for the La Crosse County School District. Dr. Harsey, thank you very much for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
And of course, you're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. If you'd like to see more of WPR's coverage of the COVID-19 issue, you can go to our website. That's WPR.org. And of course, if you're tuning in during Newsmakers expecting to hear some sort of news coverage or live press availability or something like that, those are also being offered on WPR.org as they are made available. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in just a moment here on Newsmakers from WPR. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Ezra Wall. If you'd like to get in touch with the show today, you can visit our website, which is WPR.org/newsmakers. We've been having an interesting conversation so far earlier, hearing about how the education system is affected by the COVID-19 outbreak. We're now moving to the business community, not only the effects on the business community, but one business in particular in La Crosse that is taking a novel approach and lending a helping and hopefully cleaning hand. We're visiting with La Crosse Distilling Company, specifically Chad Staley, who is the co-owner of La Crosse Distilling. Chad, thank you very much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Ezra. My pleasure. We're big supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's an honor to be speaking on air with you.
Well, thank you very much. So you're no strangers to distilling and alcoholic products, but usually those which are consumed with a tasty something to eat. But now you're shifting your production to producing sanitizers that'll help people keep their hands germ-free in this outbreak. How did you decide to do this as a company?
We saw that a distillery out on the West Coast was doing this, and it really turned on a light bulb. And, you know, everyone here that works here has been up against the same thing as we've seen everywhere, you know, going to the grocery store and the shelves being totally cleared of hand sanitizer. And we figured out that we could take a product we produce here and turn it into a hand sanitizer that can help people out in during this pandemic. So light bulbs started to go off this past week, and we decided to put the news out that we were going to initially here and hopefully long-term be able to offer this service to the general public. And the response has just been absolutely overwhelming. I know our first line of production here that we're creating is not going to be close to enough. So we're in the process of ordering a lot more of the ingredients we need to produce this, and we're going to really ramp production up and stop our regular distillation of spirits production for now and focus on this.
So how different is the alcohol that's in the hand sanitizer that you're making versus the alcohol that's in the spirits that you're normally producing?
Well, really, there is no difference, Ezra. You know, a lot of spirits, a lot of liquors start out with the same base spirit, essentially a neutral grain spirit. So really, there's not a whole lot of difference. You know, there are various subcategories of, and I'm not one of our distillers. I'm one of the owners. Our distiller could speak to this a lot better, and he's also a chemist. But, you know, there's denatured alcohol. There's ethanol, there's isopropyl alcohol, et cetera. We will be using essentially an ethanol style alcohol that we will be putting into this hand sanitizer. But essentially, all alcohols are the same. It's just measured by percent of alcohol. I believe this specific hand sanitizer will be 80% alcohol by volume.
So when people think of the product that you're normally making, it's obviously something that you drink and has the consistency of something that we've been used to seeing on the shelves in our homes or in the restaurants that we visit. Hand sanitizer, as we think about it, is a little bit thicker, stickier, so on. Is this going to feel like the hand sanitizer that we're used to?
It's not going to be gelatinous. It's going to be more liquid, but you know, more like a rubbing alcohol. It'll be somewhere in between the more gelatinous style everyone's used to and, somewhere in between that and a rubbing alcohol product. The viscosity will be somewhere in between that.
How's it going to be packaged or distributed?
We initially had ordered 5,000 2-ounce bottles that we're going to put a label on, et cetera. Given the response we've gotten, I mean, we've been contacted by state agencies, by assisted living facilities, et cetera, just in the last 4 or 5 hours since we put this out to the press. So initially, it's going to be these 2-ounce bottles that we're going to give out to the public for free. We're also going to we're ordering more product that we need to create this right now as I speak. And we're going to hopefully have behind this first initial 5,000 to 6,000 bottles, we're going to have another hopefully 10,000 to 15,000 small bottles. But then we're also ramping up production that we're going to fill gallon jugs of this and various other large format containers. We're just working on that plan right now, but we're hoping like in a week and a half to like have large volumes that various facilities and agencies could purchase, and we're going to hopefully continue to be able to give away smaller bottles to the general public as well.
There's a lot of regulation involved in the product that you normally make and normally sell. What about this? What are the controls on this kind of product?
So, you know, we actually were alerted by the TTB, which is the federal agency that regulates alcohol manufacturing. And given the dire circumstances we're in, they gave us general guidelines and labeling procedures and permission to go ahead and do this. We are following those guidelines that I believe they also consulted the FDA on as well. They sent that out to anyone that is holding a manufacturing permit. So that's how this helped come together. It's going to be Tuesday or Wednesday when people are going to be able to come and pick this up. And then as more becomes available, we'll continue to let, you know, these news outlets know about it so they can inform the public about it.
In the era of everybody being encouraged to buy local, I mean, I've thought about just about everything you can buy locally, but it never occurred to me that a local company here in town would be making hand sanitizer. Talk about how people can support the business community in light of what's been going on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, silver linings, right? And who knows what this may turn into for us. I don't think ever in a million years we thought we'd be in this space of producing hand sanitizer, but we're so thankful that we're able to help this boy because, as I said earlier, the amount of outreach and calls we've taken and emails and Facebook messages we've gotten, it's just been overwhelming to see how dire this situation is and how far the shortage reaches. So, you know, we're just glad to be able to jump in and help out here. And if it turns into a long-term thing, we're ready to do that because, you know, it's like, it's all hands on deck right now. And yeah, I mean, you know, talk about supporting local businesses. Really, La Crosse Distilling Company was built upon that. That was really a giant impetus for everything we do. You know, as much as we can with our regular spirit and liquor production, we are trying to source from local and regional farmers. Our kitchen is also reaching out to a lot of local and regional purveyors and farmers for ingredients in the kitchen. So, you know, that's always been a key element to what we've envisioned with this business here is not only being a local business, but supporting as many local businesses as we can.
I know that there are a lot of people in your industry who are particularly suffering as they've been ordered not to serve food for dine-in customers. They've got to serve it either curbside or to-go or something like that. So is this helping you to keep your employees at work?
You know, some of our staff, yes. You know, and we're working on a plan for the rest of our staff to try to support them in the face of all this. We're not fully there on that plan, but we're working hard right now to figure that out with hopefully not having to tell them all they need to go and file for unemployment. But some of our kitchen staff and some of our front of house staff is helping run the curbside pickup that we're offering with our food and because of the way our permits fall with being a distillery and manufacturing alcohol, we can sell bottles of our spirits as well. So we're offering, if people want to grab some takeout food, and they can get 10% off a bottle of our spirits to take home and pour themselves some cocktails at home.
I guess in these times, you got to get creative, right?
Exactly.
Chad Staley is the co-owner of La Crosse Distilling Company. Chad, thank you very much for sharing your story with us today.
Ezra, appreciate you getting the word out. We're here for our community, and we're wishing everyone the best of health and best of luck. And we're all in this together, and we're going to get through it, come out stronger on the other side.
Thanks, Chad. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. More information on our show can be found at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Of course, if you're looking for more of WPR's coverage, or perhaps you're here looking for a press conference or some national coverage of some kind, you can find a lot of that at our website as well, our whole organization's website, wpr.org. Coming up, a shift of gears. We're talking about the local journalism climate in a conversation with the editor and the publisher of the La Crosse Tribune. That's coming up next. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. WPR in La Crosse. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall, and we're talking about the media today, specifically media and the history of it and the future of it here in the La Crosse area, throughout the Cooley region, throughout the Driftless area. And we're joined by two people who know it very well. Sean Burke is the publisher and president of the River Valley Media Group, which includes the La Crosse Tribune. And Rusty Cunningham is the executive editor of that paper. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ezra.
Thank you.
So let me get started by just introducing our audience to each of you. Let's start with you, Sean. How about a quick overview of your media journalism career?
So I've only recently joined the River Valley Media Group mid-September of 2019. For most of my career, I was with Gatehouse Media, and most recently as leading that group in the New England area, so the greater Boston area. We published more than 100 newspapers there, more than 165 individual websites, a pretty complex organization. From there, I went to the McClatchy Company and was president and publisher of the Star Telegram out of Fort Worth, Texas, and then joining here in mid-September as president and publisher of the River Valley Media Group.
Rusty, La Crosse area residents will have heard your name before and be familiar with you as a member of the Tribune staff. But how did you get your start, and when did you make your way onto the Tribune staff?
First, I have to tell you that I have great fondness for Mark Twain, and as I think of my job, I always think of his quote about being an editor. Twain said, "I am not the editor of a newspaper and shall always try to do right and be good so that God will not make me one." Clearly, I've not been good, so here I am. I am actually the fourth consecutive generation of journalists in my family, so I like to say that I come from a family of slow learners, but a dedicated lot that cares a great deal about covering community service, doing a good job of accurate journalism and telling a community story. It's a real honor to get to tell the story of a community, the highs and the lows, the tragedies and the triumphs. So I've been at the Tribune, having been a journalist in Illinois and Iowa for a number of years, in Nebraska, and I've been here since August 1st of 1997, so that's been quite a while. I've been with Lee Enterprises actually 41 years later this month.
Obviously, the media landscape has changed a lot over the years. I remember when I was delivering La Crosse Tribunes all over South La Crosse, and before that in Onalaska, you'd stop at virtually every house on the block and drop a paper. And in some neighborhoods, it might be every other house. Now I'm thinking of the block that I live on in South La Crosse, and there are a couple of papers in driveways, or up in, you know, in the ubiquitous red La Crosse Tribune boxes on the block. Most of the people that I know take it digitally. How has people's consumption of your main product, the daily newspaper, changed as you've seen it over the years?
Yeah, so I think what you're witnessing there is the very transformation that media companies are undergoing, and La Crosse Tribune is no exception. As our readership moves increasingly away from printed newspapers and increasingly towards digital channels, including our websites, you're seeing a decline in print circulation. But what is maybe less obvious is that the size of the audience that is consuming news and information produced by the team at the La Crosse Tribune has never been bigger.
The building that you occupy, I mean, the print operation isn't there anymore. There's a lot more empty offices in that building than there used to be, though. So from a journalistic standpoint, how do you convince the public that as journalists you're still an active part of their community when they see, you know, the building with fewer and fewer occupants all the time?
Well, I would suggest a couple of things. Using your analogy about your neighborhood, again, to emphasize what Sean just said, we've never had a larger audience. So you may only see a limited number of papers going to the doorstep, but everyone in those houses is consuming our information on a regular basis. I'm looking at this wonderful studio that I've been honored to be in several times, and I look at this wonderful digital setup, and over your right shoulder is a turntable. So all of our businesses have gone through transformation. There's not a one that hasn't been touched by technology. I was asked the other day about a survey done at University of North Carolina, and it talked about this phenomenon of ghost newspapers. And when you talk about journalism, I will tell you that in a couple weeks, the Wisconsin Newspaper Association will honor the Tribune with a slew of journalism awards, including 5 first place awards. And they're for such things as an environmental story. Not a lot of papers necessarily have an environmental reporter. But that's something that we key on is important because the environment, you used the word driftless a bit ago, is so important in our region to people that covering that well is really an important priority. But I think the website numbers in particular, the audience numbers will show people are paying attention very much to our good work when it comes to being good journalists. And we have a monitor up in our newsroom that shows us a spike when we've got a breaking story that's online, the spike in audience. So believe me, that's not a coincidence. That's because we have people who are thirsty for the kind of information that we produce on an hourly basis.
Sean, the Tribune is moving out of its longtime location, not the only location it's had in La Crosse over the years, but certainly the location it's been in for most of my life, sold the big Tribune building downtown, and you're getting ready to move into another historic La Crosse location, which is the old Rubber Mills building on the north side. Talk about that move. What led to it, and what advantages it presents to your company?
Yeah, as you may know, the La Crosse Tribune has been labeled as a wandering spirit in its more than 100-year history, and we've had several locations throughout La Crosse that we would call home. Yes, we recently sold our building. Our building at one point had been housed many other regional functions for Lee Enterprises, including call centers. We did printing, obviously, from there. And through the changes where we've centralized a lot of those operations, the building has outgrown us, simply. We're a smaller operation than we were. And we feel like that property, although it's beloved and we're excited about being part of the downtown, we think it can be used by someone else in a better way. So we're excited to move to the La Crosse Footwear Company, the old boot factory, and really excited about blending the history of the La Crosse Tribune with the history of that property. So it's a very exciting development for us and for our employees.
And I think the other part of that is that nostalgia is a wonderful thing, but it often means a dirty carpet too. So, you know, at a certain point, I have to tell you, I've moved newspaper offices a number of times in my career. I've never seen a building put out a newspaper. I've never seen a building put out a radio broadcast. People do. A building is a building, but people who have a passion for what we do, for providing local information, local journalism, that matters a whole lot than the spot that you're in. And I think going to the Rubber Mills, a historic building on the north side, is really cool. And I've heard there's a brewery not far away, so there, I buried the lead.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall, and I'm talking today with Rusty Cunningham, the executive editor of the La Crosse Tribune, and Sean Burke, who's the publisher and president of the River Valley Media Group, which owns the La Crosse Tribune, and a couple of other papers in the area that people would be would know. The paper in Winona?
Yes, the Winona Daily News,
yeah.
The Chippewa Herald,
okay,
among several of our weeklies.
Yeah, so we're speaking with them, and we will continue our discussion about the modern media and what's going on there, and that continues. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can do that. All of our contact information is available on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. We're talking about the media today, not just public radio, but newspaper in particular. And we're joined by Sean Burke, who's the publisher and president of the River Valley Media Group, which includes the La Crosse Tribune, and Rusty Cunningham, the executive editor of the Tribune. And I thank you both for staying with us for another segment. We were talking before the break about the printing press and about how things are changing, and I understand the concept of how consolidating printing operations into a different location and having the actual paper printed, outside of La Crosse, which ours is an economic idea. I've talked to some people in recent weeks who I know a lot of information is available on the website, but some people just they like the daily paper, or even some people who read it digitally read the digital version of the actual newspaper. They're not just clicking on individual articles. And I've heard some frustration from people like that if it doesn't happen by 6 o'clock in the evening the previous day, it's not going to be in the paper. And this time of year, we're talking about election results, even the final score of the Super Bowl, was not in the paper because it's printed out of town and the deadline is much earlier. Can you speak to how the expectations of what's actually in the paper have changed and how you make those decisions?
Well, I think clearly we have to print earlier if we're going to get a truck back from Madison and get the paper on the doorstep when our readers expect it, which is bright and early. It doesn't have everything that it once did, but we have so much more information now available earlier and digitally. So instead of seeing a small recap in print of a game, for instance, we'll have a lot of information online the night of the game, but also we have sports reporters who will go out, take video, tape an interview with a coach, show clips of the performance, photo galleries, that sort of thing. So actually we have much more information much sooner that is available. And our subscribers get a whole suite of our products that include print and digital. So, yes, it's changed some, but in many respects, it's a lot of information. One of the examples I can give you, too, and it's not so much about the time, but just the breadth of what digital can allow. We do restaurant inspections every month that we pay, as taxpayers, we pay County Health to do inspections of area restaurants. And we've been doing this for years and years. Well, when these come out, we'll have maybe a 6-inch story in print that says the inspections are out and how many violations there were, just frankly scratching the surface. But if you go on our website and click on, then all of a sudden here comes a database of the last 5 inspections of that particular restaurant. Not only a searchable database, but there's mapping that allows you to click on, I'm not sure where this restaurant is. I see this dot here. I'll click on, yeah, that's the restaurant. Here it is. And up pops all the information from the most recent inspection, but also previous ones. You could never do that in print. So our digital readers are pretty savvy and understand that there are a lot of whiz-bang things that we can do on a website that we never could do in print.
I'm glad you brought up restaurants because in spite of my long career in broadcast journalism, the article that I click on with the most regularity is the weekly column about which restaurants are opening and closing and where I can get Asian food or Indian food or which pizza place is coming to town or whatever. How do you strike a balance there between the news people want, so to speak, versus the harder journalism that people might expect you to spend your resources on?
Well, so what is journalism? And we could go for hours about what that is. But journalism is all sorts of things to all sorts of readers. We don't have a webcast, but all three of us at the table know where to find a good meal, clearly. And our readers care about that sort of thing. Now, is that necessarily hard journalism? Well, it depends how you define that, but I promise you that when a Caribou Coffee decides it's going to come to the South Side and we get a scoop on that, wow, the web audience for that just goes crazy. But that also doesn't mean and doesn't preclude us from doing other more in-depth journalism to look at CAFOs in our community and groundwater issues and legislation that's proposed and doing watchdog journalism. You know, I would argue it's never been an either or. We have a wide and varied audience with a lot of different interests. And I will honestly tell you that as journalists, sometimes we'll do a pretty hard-hitting piece. And yeah, that thing about Caribou may get a little more traffic. Well, that doesn't mean we're doing a bad job of anything. It just means that that digital audience, and I would argue often that is different from the print audience, cares about certain things that pop up. That's okay. It's our role to provide all of that.
I would add, yeah. Ezra, that although our efforts to more effectively manage the declining aspect of our business, which is the print component of our business, and do that with actions such as print outsourcing, and it no doubt has affected the content strategy within the printed newspaper. But make no mistake that despite that presentation in print being delayed, we are not backing off our responsibilities towards breaking news, towards sports scores. We're just publishing those in the more immediate medium, which is our online channels. And what we're finding is that the vast majority of our audience, in any given week, 70% of the community reads our product or our content on a weekly basis. And the vast majority of that 70% of the audience is, or 70% of the market, is reading us in multiple platforms. They're reading us online for breaking news. They're reading us in print for the follow-up analytics on that. So it's a very much a complementary strategy across platforms, and our readers are following us.
And I think when I talk to business groups, realizing a lot of them keep tabs on what's going on in the community. I'll be in front of a group of business owners and I'll tell them, now I know this doesn't happen at your business, but there are plenty of people who read the paper in the morning and come to work and immediately log on to lacrossetribune.com to figure out what's going on in the community. Now I know that doesn't happen in your workplace because they're all very diligent and they never look at information like that.
Never.
And all I get nodding of heads saying, yeah, I do that too. So, you know, our readers are really savvy.
Yeah.
They've figured out where they can get certain kinds of information and the immediacy of the website, but they also look to us both print and online for such things as editorials and editorial columns. We continue to be a community center, if you will, when it comes to people submitting letters to the editor. We have in recent weeks had full pages of letters to the editor from people who want to be heard in the pages and on the website of the La Crosse Tribune. We still write editorials about what's going on and urging certain action or scolding occasionally when that's called for. And I think Sean will tell you, it's interesting how many people want to meet with our editorial board. And I think that's a really healthy sign. And quite frankly, sometimes we hear people say, gee, there aren't many editorial boards left in this state or in this region. But when the governor comes to town, he pays us a visit. Yesterday, Sean and I were in Winona meeting with the head of the Minnesota State Chamber of Commerce because they want to talk to us about something that their legislative priorities, which they laid out in a column the week earlier that we published. So I think it's a blend. It's a mix. People often don't get information in just one spot, and it's our role to try to figure out how we can best suit their needs.
We've talked a lot today about the different ways or the different types of information that media companies, including River Valley and the Tribune, are putting out there. But a thing that's a common thread in discussions, as you both know, behind closed doors in the media, in journalism, is the level of distrust that exists in the community towards the media. Some of it based maybe on the preponderance of media, how easy it is to create a quote unquote media source, and people see this, and those are not always trustworthy, and maybe that spills over into our industry. But some of it is just people's lack of understanding of how journalism works, what the difference is, for example, between an editorial board or you know, somebody who's doing actual reporting on a subject. How can we as journalists rebuild the trust that used to be placed in us by the community?
Ezra, you just used the J word, and I'm telling you, that's the key. You used the word media a bit ago. Well, what's that? Is that Hollywood? Is that commercials? Is that video games? Media is used for all sorts of catch-all industries, but that's not journalism. The best thing that journalists can do is look people right in the eye and say, we're journalists. Now, I understand that I'm the enemy of the American people, and I get all that. But let me tell you, the number of news tips I get on a daily basis, the amount of respect in this community for our institution, the number of people who want to see their letters to the editor published in our pages, if they didn't trust us, they wouldn't do it. If the governor thought we were a bunch of clowns, he wouldn't come to our office every time he comes to town to talk to us about priorities he's got that he wants to discuss. So I feel strongly as a journalist that we need to talk about journalism and differentiate from the popular notion of what media are, because that's a real catch-all for a lot of people, and frankly, it makes no sense.
One of the things that's happened over the years, and I'm going to phrase this question in a general way in case you are not able to address it specifically, but just for the sake of our audience, bringing them up to speed with where my question's coming from. Warren Buffett famously got involved in newspapers some years back by making big investments, buying up a bunch of troubled products and trying to, you know, get them turned around, and there was a lot of coverage of that. Recently, he jumped out of that business, selling basically all of the papers that he had previously bought. Some of them bought by Lee Enterprises, which is the parent organization of the River Valley Media Group and the Tribune. I don't know if you can or can't address that specifically, but in general, my question is if a large investor like that, with the capital available to him and his company and other large scale investors who might have done similar things over the years, can't make a go of it running newspapers, how does a more regional group, what has to happen with local newspapers and the regionally based companies that own them, whether it's Lee or whether it's another enterprise, in order to make those things, keep those things viable for the future?
So I guess how I would address that is, first of all, Warren Buffett has a great relationship and a great trust in the leadership of Lee Enterprises, and very much entrusted his group to Lee Enterprises. And much of that was built on Lee's reputation of being industry-leading operators, consistently outperforming peers. And at Lee, and I would speak more specifically for the River Valley Media Group, we have a very clear vision for the future of our media company and how it will sustain and prosper in the new, very competitive media marketplace. And you put Google's in there and Facebook's in there, and on it goes, as Rusty alluded to. And we see our future in certainly in journalism. That will always, has been since the founding of the La Crosse Tribune, and forever will be the foundation for our business model. So journalism is our priority, always has been and always will be. But what we see is a diversification, and that diversification has us moving away from printed advertising, for example, which is under secular pressure and in slow decline, and moving toward areas of growth. And in areas of growth where we can utilize our strengths in convening audiences, in distributing and producing journalism, and move in those directions. So certainly digital media and the growth of our online platforms, LaCrosseTribune.com among them. As well, we see opportunities in things such as content marketing. We see avenues in event marketing. You know, we're looking to in the near future greatly expanding the live experience associated with our readers and the La Crosse Tribune. And we envision those strategies diversifying away from slow growing industries and or categories, and moving our business increasingly toward growth categories. We will first bring stability to our business, and then prosperity.
And Sean, you know this a lot better than I do, but the deal with Berkshire Hathaway also includes helping to finance debt over 25-year periods.
Yes, absolutely.
And 25 years is a long time that I think says something, too, about the confidence of where we're headed.
Many companies within our industry are under the pressures associated with debt service. There was a lot of consolidation in the industry and expansion through acquisition, and a lot of companies took on debt. And that debt has shortened the runway for many companies, and for some time it had shortened Lee's runway as well. This relationship and transaction with Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett included recapitalization of debt, which, as Rusty alluded to, provides patient capital for our company and provides a runway for us to affect this transition that we've been describing. So a very positive development for certainly for Lee Enterprises, and most certainly for the communities that we serve.
I've got a very short amount of time, and maybe it's not even fair to ask you to sum this one up in 30 seconds, but I'd like to get each of you to comment on the sort of the future of your industry or the future of journalism in general, and tell me what is something about the future of journalism that is on the horizon that makes you excited?
Well, digital and the immediacy and the interactive capability. Again, I look at our large audience. It's never been bigger, and it's growing. And that has to excite anyone who's in our business.
And I would add that, you know, since the founding of the La Crosse Tribune more than 100 years ago, to today and to the future, I would say that truth isn't a fad. And our ability to deliver our journalism, our local journalism, our credible journalism across now multiple platforms where we had for so long been limited to simply newsprint and newsprint delivery, I think is a very exciting development and promise for our industry.
We've been speaking today with Rusty Cunningham, the executive editor of the La Crosse Tribune, and Sean Burke, the publisher and president of the Tribune's parent organization, the River Valley Media Group. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ezra.
Thanks, Ezra.
And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. If you're looking for more coverage on COVID-19, and Wisconsin's reaction in particular, you can find that on our website, WPR.org. And if you've tuned in looking for a news conference or other national coverage of the virus and its rollout and the rollout of the United States' response, you can find that on our website as well. It's WPR.org. You can find this and other episodes of Newsmakers at our website. You can also get in touch with me there. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Thank you again for joining us today. I'm Ezra Wall. My co-producer is John Davis, and we'll be back here next week for another Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.